Welcome to the Breakout CEO Podcast, the show where ambitious founders and scaling CEOs share how they put insight into action and spark pivotal moments, bold moves, and powerful mindset shifts. From building technology and growing teams to navigating pressure and pushing through plateaus, this is where real leaders talk about what it takes to level up in both business growth and leadership skills. I'm Jeff Holman, attorney and founder of Intellectual Strategies. I work behind the scenes with scaling CEOs and get a front row seat to the decisions that drive breakout success. On this show, you'll hear directly from exceptional CEOs about their breakout moments so you can learn how they navigated the risks and opportunities while scaling a business from startup to success. Let's get started. Hello again. I'm Jeff Holman. I'm hosting this podcast, The Breakout CEO, because I want to talk to really cool people like Phil Alves that I've got here. Phil is the founder of Dev Squad. If you've tried to build a SaaS product, you might have looked to him to help you do it. He's got a team that helps people, bootstrappers and founders, build out SaaS products, and he'll be able to tell us more about that. But Phil, I'm super glad to have you on the show. We were having a really good conversation just leading up to the recording here, and I'm excited to continue that.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, of course, of course. You and I have worked together for a little bit. We've done a little bit of trademark work for your company, and that's gone thankfully. But you've started this really cool business, Dev Squad, and you've been running it now for, what, 10, 11 years? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Give the audience just a flavor for what that is. I told them a little bit, but you'll tell them like the accurate version.
So Dev Squad, we help people build products and solve real problems. Usually we're working with industry experts. So they are an expert in the industry and they have a problem they want to solve to a SaaS application. And then we help them build and then they go and they sell the product. So we have built products in many industries, like for accountants, for the airplane space, in the healthcare space and financial devices space, you name it. So basically people come to us and our goal is to help people put odds in their favor when they're creating a product and take the risks of building a product. Because many times, actually 80% of every product that people try to build will fail. It's actually very hard to take a product off the ground. By failing, it doesn't even get done. And then there's the companies that actually launch something and then turns into nothing. And so our job is to be the engine. Founders, many times they're second or third time founders building the software product. So that's what Dev Squad does. And we have about 100 people that work for us now. It started 10 years ago. It was just me and three other people. And the same like model, the original squad, it works so well. If there was two developers, a tester, a product manager, and a designer, that was like the original squad. And then we were able to replicate, and that's what all our customers get. So yeah, Dev Squad in a nutshell.
Yeah, I love that. A couple things come to mind. Your squad concept really reminds me of what we're doing with our fractional legal team, trying to get a team of attorneys into practice with startups and scaling companies. So the squad idea, the team idea, I think it's a recipe for success. The second thing it makes me think of is, man, as an attorney, a service provider, maybe I should be building an app. So when I get to that point, I got to come to you and have you help me with it.
Yeah, that's kind of like most of our customers are people just like you. Like, hey, I know this industry so well. I understand trademarks so well. And I'm doing all this manual process to make sure things get done. What if I build a product for other people just like me? Because you know the problem better than anybody else. So then you come to us, we would talk about the problems and how maybe you solve internally in your firm with spreadsheets, with your own, like maybe systems, but that's not scalable for you to go sell for other people. But now you can turn that into something that other people can use. When I done that for a lot of people, and eventually I did for myself too, because what I do is I run engineer teams, development teams very successfully that can actually ship stuff and allow teams to be high performing. So I build a software that does just that, allow you to connect to your team and help them be high performing, understanding where they're going and mentor them and coach them and get the most out of your development team. It's like Google Analytics for development teams. That's my product. But I built that after I saw so many of our customers being super successful, building a thing for their industry that they were already using internally. And that's basically what I help people do.
That's fantastic. And at the end of the show, let's remember to tell people how to get in touch with you, because there are probably a lot more people that need your services and just need to know how to get a hold of you. In fact, I wonder, with all the SaaS companies that we've worked with as a law firm, I wonder if you've actually been the engine that's built the products for the companies that are now our clients. I don't know how to find that out without getting into customer lists and stuff like that, but I bet there are some out there.
For sure.
Some overlap.
So. For sure. There's a lot of very successful companies in Utah that we were like, they're 0 to 1, and even outside of Utah.
That's cool. So I want to know a little bit about, you've told us you got about your team, what your company does. What are a few things that you've done before we get into your breakout moment, which you gave me a preview of it earlier, and I'm super excited to talk about it. But before we get into the breakout moment conversation, tell me a little bit about maybe one or two achievements that you guys have had the last, I don't know, since you started, anytime in the last 10 years. And I'd love to hear about one thing you're working on. What's a milestone that you're working towards with your team? Just to give us a little bit more context about your business.
Yeah, so I think one of the biggest challenges they were able to overcome, it's scaling a service business is very hard. Starting a service business, it's great because it's easy to start. It's profitable from day one and you can get customers. But then you get to the point where you get stagnated. And how can you actually scale a service business? And I think we're able to do that and go past like that. Most service businesses stay small, like 10 people, and they can serve just a few companies, because you need systems, you need processes, you need things to be able to put in place to scale. And I always actually thought, hey, maybe I can build the Deloitte of software development, because there's so many accounting, local accountants that don't scale. And then there's this huge accounting firm that's huge and there's accounting for everybody. So that was our thinking. How can we build a development company, a dev shop that is not just a small thing and that can actually be replicated, that can scale and that doesn't depend on me, and that we can build reliable playbooks that we can reuse. Yeah. And that's what we have been doing. And I believe we've done very successful over the last 10 years is write those playbooks. And of course, the playbook that work at one size, not going to work at the next size, but to actually build a service company that has over 100 people working at, it's pretty hard. And I think we got to a good place.
Yeah. Yeah. So many people have struggled with that, because it's, you're right. Whether you're an attorney, an accountant, a software developer, it's easy to just put your shingle out there, start a business, start making some revenue. If depending on how you account for expense and everything, there's quite a high profit margin in that usually. Mm-hmm. So you get into this thing where you just take that and pay myself. But how to scale that is totally different. It's an entirely different business model than just the straight up service model that most people think of. In fact, I talked with a guy when I first came out of my undergrad in engineering. I was doing an internship with a company. They were doing power and lighting design for a lot of larger commercial buildings, hospitals, churches, stuff like that. And I talked with the owner one day and I said, hey, how did you grow this to the size that it is? I think they had 50 or 60 engineers at the time. Mm-hmm. And he said, Jeff, it was really easy to get to about 15 engineers because we just operated like a normal service company. And then it was really easy. Once we got to 25, it was really pretty easy to grow to the size we are now. But getting from 15 to 25 was so hard. It was difficult to grow because you have to run the business totally differently than you've been running it just to get to 15 people. And he didn't mention systems and processes and all that, playbooks, but I'm certain that's exactly what he had to do to get past that, get over that hump to where it became a business instead of just a service provider.
Yeah. My favorite book on the topic is a book called Emit. And he talks about first you are the doer and then you are the manager, but then you become an actual business owner. You become actual CEO. And making that transition in a service business is very hard because you cannot be the doer all the time. You have to be in every call. You can't be the principal of every single strategy that get done in your service company. And so making that transition is pretty hard. Like, where are you just going to go from being a high pay consultant to actually become a CEO? And one of the tests I like to do, it's like, can you go on a trip for a few weeks and everything is going to be okay? If not, there's something wrong with your systems. Go back and try to fix those systems and try to put systems in place that can be repeatable, that people can actually do. And so I love service business because they're so profitable. And I think most people should start there. Getting a service business from, like you say, from the 10 to 15 to a bigger organization is very challenging, but it's also very profitable if you can actually do it. Yeah. So it's worth doing.
Yeah. I'm really curious in your experience, and we don't need to dive too deep in this, but your comments have me wondering now, in your path of building your company, was it the processes that got you there? Did you have some key people who were able to step in? Or was it a combination of both? Because I imagine I've been working on this law firm and different kind of iterations of it for quite some time. And I've stepped away once or twice. And fortunately, things have worked out really well that way. But it's scary when you go, and especially if you're going to Everest Base Camp and you don't have much cell service very continually. Mm-hmm. Like, we're going to see how this goes. What for you, was it playbooks that you put together? Were there people involved that you helped to train and trusted? What was that moment where you said, hey, I can actually go and we'll see how this works the first time?
Yeah, so it's the playbooks, but the culture. I feel like the culture is super important. And culture is not like what we put in the wall, but it's the way that we do things around here. How can we learn? What's the culture of the company? How we solve this kind of problems? How we train other people? Like I always like to say, if you're a leader inside my company, your main job is to create other leaders. If you cannot do that, you're a very bad leader. And to teach people like the processes and so forth. So I think that's what's very important. It becomes a lot about having a strong culture,
yeah,
and a lot having the right processes, but the people are going to follow. It was the two things that I really were focused on. What is the playbook, and how can we get the people to actually think in a similar way and to understand what they're supposed to do, what is expected of them, and that you do through a tight control on culture. And like, we even have a culture squad. We had a team inside the company that their only job is to make sure that people understand what we're trying to do and how we think.
Very, very Zappo-esque. Zappos had the whole culture.
Exactly.
Tony Hsieh, right? Mm-hmm. He wrote that book about being happy, I believe it was called.
Yes, exactly. I think that's what's required to scale an organization, and especially a service organization.
Yeah. Do you have any big milestones that you're working on, that something like you're trying to grow the team to a certain size or get to a revenue point or some other metric that you use? What's one of your milestones that your team's focused on working towards?
Yeah. So for the many, like for the like beginning of the company, like the first maybe 5-6 years, we would like double every year. It was fun. When you're small, you just like you're doubling. But you get to a point where that's not feasible to do anymore, and you cannot keep growing as fast and not break stuff. So like what we're trying to accomplish now is grow 10-15% a year, have a lot of value to our customers, a lot of value to the people that work inside the organization. So those are the main goals. I think for me, having optionality is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Yes, I could go and grow faster. Oh, I could go and get a loan. The goal of my business is to give me optionality. And it's kind of like what I optimize for. And that's the main thing that I know if I'm being successful or not. We were talking before the show start, like I love flying.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's Wednesday morning and I'm like, I'm going to go fly.
So optionality for you means having some, can I say optionality is the same as having some balance in what you do? Is that the same thing for you?
Having balance, but also having options of like accepting customers, not accepting customers, deciding to grow, decide not to grow, decide to do a layoff, decide not to do a layoff if things go to a rough path. So just have options, and that's kind of what I try to optimize for. It's build a strong company that has options, or, we're going to launch a new product. So that's like what I try to optimize the business. And that's where you're working towards, building a business that's strong in that sense.
Where you're the master of the domain. It sounds like you don't necessarily have any outside investor. I don't know if you have investors or not, but it sounds like this isn't what you just described isn't what a lot of people in the VC growth world would describe their company. They'd be like, man, I have no options. I got to build and I got to double and I got to get all my profit margin percentages right, because if I'm not there, I got investors I got to answer to. And they don't necessarily, they've chosen different goals than optionality, I think.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. I definitely don't have investors. And yeah, those are different goals. And that's not something that I'm looking to do. Like, I feel like there's more opportunity in growing a company. Like, it's so much easier to grow a $10 million company than it is to build a $100 million company. And if you build a $10 million company in the VC world, you fail, right? You have to at least make $100 million a year to be successful. So we talk about that, like,
we're going to talk about the breakout moment. But for me, I'm always like trying to put the odds in my favor. And I'm always trying to be like, okay, this is it's going to be okay. I don't want to be at the bottom 50%, but I don't need to be at the top 1% either.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. That's a good segue into the breakout moment, because you mentioned it before about putting the odds in your favor. I want to hear a little bit about maybe what the circumstances were like when you think back to that moment where you were maybe, it sounds like you've had a great successful career, when you were thinking, hey, how do I make this better? And eventually you hit that button and it just maybe gave you better optionality or increased your revenue or whatever the breakout was, that, as you would define it. What was going on that time in your business? What led up to this point where you started to make that transition?
Yeah. So like when I start Dev Squad as a service company was like the only option that I had, right? I didn't have a lot of resources and I work as a software developer somewhere else. And I thought, hey, I can start a company. I have this skill and I can do a service that's going to offer software development. But the end goal was always like, one day I want to build this huge company and I want to build that $1 billion company. So that was the mentality. But that service company started growing and growing slowly. And then I start having customers that actually sign up for the exact goal that went and raised Series A and Series B. and these people are like stressed and they're losing their hair and they're getting bigger. you know?
To me, both, we serve the same clients and we watch them. It's funny because I see the same thing and I see people who they pitch an idea 1 year and then 2 years later, they've raised $4 million. And then the next year they've grown three times and the next year their business is over and they're doing something else perhaps, or maybe they've grown. So, yeah. It's interesting when you watch that from a service provider's perspective, isn't it?
Exactly. And then I start seeing that. But one thing that I noticed too, it's like a lot of those people, they come from a different background than I come from. So a lot of the people that are going and they're really trying to make a bunch of money and the person raising money and they want to build a unicorn, they come from a family that have means and they are, if everything goes south, they're going to be okay no matter what. And we do live in a country that we're very blessed that way they can always go and find a job and like get yourself back up. But where I come from, I didn't have anywhere to fall off. So if I messed up and so...
For the audience, share a little bit more about when you say where I come from. So, they might not know that. Where is that?
So I grew up in Brazil. My mother was a teacher. My father worked in construction, so didn't come from money at all. So like a lower middle class family. The only reason I moved to the United States is because I started a company and I was able to sell the company very early in my life. So that there's not that cushion. Like really when you feel like about the first timers, like, hey, this. Like many times when you, 80% of the people that come into some money, that was the first time. But like, I see that a lot of people, yes, but they come from like parents that had a better career and they were able to help them a little bit more. And so that's all good and all, but it's like your perception of risks are different when depending on how you're raised, on how much safe net you have. I believe that. Yeah. My kids will be able to take a lot more risks than I did because they're going to be in a better place. Like even if you think like the very rich people like Elon Musk or Bill Gates, they come from families that allow them to take very huge risks.
Totally agree. I was actually just having a conversation with my wife, Brooke, yesterday about this. We just sent one of our kids off, our third child off to college. And I was just thinking about how good... We're fortunate, like you say, we live in a place where not everybody, but a lot of us have the opportunity to allow our kids to try things. And if they fail, that's not the end for them, right? They have the opportunity to fail and a fallback position to come back to if they do fail. And so that's, if you don't have that, I think you do, you approach life differently. You approach business differently than if you have that, I'll try this. If it doesn't work, I'll just try something else because I've got that option, right? Mm-hmm. We're fortunate that way, a lot of us. And I think there's probably a mix in our audience of scaling CEOs. Some have come from the background you have, and they said, and this might drive your approach of de-risking situations, your approach to find success. And we'll get into that now, but it might be different than somebody else's, which is, yeah, I just went out, I raised a bunch of money. I built the tower before I had a foundation to it. And if it works, I'll build a foundation later. If it doesn't work, I'll just build another tower somewhere else, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But for me, it was like seeing again people going through that. And I feel like in life, you can choose kind of like what the game that you want to play, what's the journey, like kind of like choose your own adventure. And then when I realized, okay, that's a cool adventure, and maybe one day I might want to choose that adventure, but that's not what I wanted to do at this point in my life. People sometimes, there's this thing, oh, you have a lifestyle business. It's okay. I love my lifestyle. That's what I'm trying to build.
Flying on a Wednesday morning doesn't sound so bad.
Exactly. So, but depending on which, like where you are, it's going to be looked upon. Like, what? That's a lifestyle business. I'm like, so what?
But yeah, you know, no, to each his own.
Yeah.
So you came from Brazil. You came from a family where you didn't have a lot. Sounds like you were blessed with a mom and dad, but not tons of money, and built a company, sold it, you moved to the US. What happened next?
So I moved here and went to school here. I had a job here and then got married. So that's why I stay here, married a girl from here. And then I was like, hey, I want to start a business. So we had the mortgage, we have everything, because I had a business before and I had the entrepreneur bug already.
Yeah.
And so that's like when I decided to start Dev Squad, I thought there was an opportunity to start a company that would specialize in building products. I thought there was opportunities to hire talent in Brazil, where I'm originally from. A lot of people are hiring talent in Asia, but in Brazil, we have a closer time zone. We have a closer culture. And I thought there would be a great opportunity there. So I spoke with my wife and I was like, hey, do you mind paying the mortgage so I can go start a business?
Yeah. Doesn't hurt to have some help from your spouse, huh?
and that's how it went.
She said yes, apparently. She said no, she doesn't mind. Yes, you can do that. So let's get into this breakout moment then. What was that transition for you? Where was the point in time or the shift in mindset or the insight, the spark that you had that really kicked off your business?
Yeah, so I think it was a few years into the business, I realized that my goal is, again, is to stay in the game. And my goal as a CEO is just to figure out how can I put the odds in my favor. And then going into areas that maybe were boring, but that I had a bigger chance of success. And that's kind of what started to make the business grow and what we're going to optimize. There's always the next hot thing that you can go and chase this hype or that hype. Since I started a business for 10 years, we had blockchain, we had crypto, we had NFTs, now we have AI. There's always the next thing that you can go and go after. But I realized that it's better to go after the things that's not going to change and figure out what are like the places where you can place bets and win. And I remember reading a book, I don't know what book it was, but the guy was talking about playing poker. And if you go play at the penny table, you have less to lose and you're going to have a better chance of winning. And then you move to the next table, to the next table. And that's kind of like the realization that I had. And that's kind of what I did with my service company, was maybe we actually start just trying to win business in Utah. And then we went to win business all over the country. And now I have a software business and that's kind of going up in complexity and also risks, but I'm better prepared to take those risks. So that's like how I start to thinking about building companies and building products.
Yeah, I like that. It makes me think your idea of identifying risks and building to avoid the risks, essentially, to become more successful. I'm going to simplify that to my own life. I love playing soccer. In fact, I think you play some soccer too, and we might be in the same outdoor soccer group, although I've only gone once and had some weird injury that was... In fact, this comes into play. Like I went there, I played, I had a back thing and part of my stomach went numb. I don't know. It's the strangest thing, but I actually play soccer we've designed an indoor futsal pickup group, and you're welcome to come play anytime, of course, if you like.
Yeah, fun.
Yeah. The only rule we have is, hey, we're too old to get injured. We're trying to avoid the risks that come with playing soccer in other environments, right? You go play indoor soccer or sometimes outdoor and you're playing against people who think they're in the World Cup and they want to take you out and they want to punch you in the face. Even sometimes you're like, whoa, I am not here to exert dominance or to get a career ending, my little soccer career ending injury. I'm here because I enjoy it. I want to play. And to some extent, thinking about it from the framework that you just mentioned, I think I play soccer in a way that avoids the risks so that I can keep playing soccer. Cause to me, continuing to play soccer, that is the success.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's definitely something that I apply in other areas of my life too. Like I'm always thinking about how can I put the odds in my favor? Like you talk about soccer for sure, like how you're playing with people that are not going to be crazy. Or I like cycling. So I road bike, but I don't actually road bike in the road. There's a lot of trails in Utah. There's the Murdoch Trail. There's like the trail next to the Jordan River Trail. There's so many trails that you stay away from the actual road. And that's putting the odds in your favor. No car is going to hit me if I'm not in the street.
I want to know how that mindset works with flying, because flying is, in some ways, at least I'm not a pilot, but it seems like flying is maybe a higher risk activity. Is that the case, or do you approach flying the same way that you do cycling or business?
Yes, exactly the same way. Like I feel before I go out, how does the weather look like? Because if the weather is bad, I'm not putting the odds in my favor. Like how am I maintaining my airplane? How often am I flying? How much I'm studying? How often I'm taking lessons? Going through emergency situations. So I think when you think about risk, what's risky for me is not going to be risky for you, and vice versa, because it's also a lot about how we develop and what you learn and how you become better at managing those risks. So I only fly when the risk is very low. And maybe as I have more and more experience, what low risk is to me is different than a low risk for a pilot that has fewer hours than I do. But that's definitely applies the same. I'm always like, okay, how I'm putting the odds in my favor. And if the odds are not in my favor, then I don't have to fly. It's a hobby. If I really need to be somewhere, I buy a Delta ticket.
Exactly. So no reason to fly in the bad weather.
Exactly.
Okay, a side question here. What kind of plane do you, I wish I were more of an aficionado here, but I'm not. But I'm sure some of our listeners will know what you're talking about. Tell us just a little bit about your plane that you fly, how many hours you have, maybe your license rating, whatever, any of that stuff that would be interesting to the audience.
Yeah, so I fly a Cirrus SR22. It's a 4-seater. It goes about 200 miles an hour.
And so you mentioned that's the one, it's a replica behind you, right?
Yes, that's exactly the replica behind me here. So we look. Let's see if I can get it. Yeah. It's like this. It's this.
Oh, that's
color.
Bigger than that shelf is far away. That's a bigger replica than I thought it was.
Yeah. So is this like, this is the tail number, which is the what you call, and then there's the seats. And actually has a parachute that comes from the top if something goes wrong, and then the parachute can like safely put the airplane down.
Famously, de-risking.
De-risking, exactly. So safe, like famously, there was this guy, he was the Walmart CEO, and he took off, and then he lost control of the airplane, and then he pulled the parachute, and then he lands right next to the freeway, and he survived. And yes, again, this is the de-risking portion.
You're like, I want that plane with the parachute.
Exactly. They'll play things in my favor. Yeah, so that's the airplane that I fly. I have about 400 hours on it.
Okay.
It's the fastest single engine airplane that's out there. So after that, there's, of course, jets and turboprops. It's going to be a lot quicker. But yeah, it's a fun, very comfortable airplane to go places.
Yeah. I haven't flown much in small planes, but the few times I have, it's interesting and exciting. Maybe I'll join you one day.
Yeah, let's do it.
So back to your breakout moment. Was there a specific like thing that happened in your business? You've got this kind of mentality of de-risking. And is there a time when you maybe went against that and you said, hey, I know I normally de-risk these situations, but I'm just going to take a swing at this one. Have you done that in your business, or are you really consistent with following the plan?
I'm mostly consistent, but definitely there's times where I'm like, wait, this is more risk than I want to be taking. And then we take a step back. Like 2020 actually was amazing for my kind of business.
Really?
It was bad for the world. Like everyone's staying at home, but like people start to realize how important software is and how you can use software to automate and to get your work done from home. And so the business exploded at that time. And then I was like hiring and the people start to drop the ball here and there. And then I realized that I'm not in this to grow super fast and to create problems and to have a business that's kind of like unmanageable because we were growing faster than we're supposed to. And we actually went 4 months without taking any new customers, people calling us every, hey, I have a project. And then I start putting people down on a wait list. Hey, we can't, we are to the point we lost a few customers because we were trying to do so quick and then our playbooks were like not working. And so I was like, okay, that's not what we're here for. I don't need to grow this. At the end of the day, I'm still getting well paid and I'm looking for peace and to balance over other priorities. So then we basically went 4 months without taking any new customers so we could build the infrastructure to keep growing. It was still the best year that we had so far. And we grew 150% in 2020.
Wow. Even with people on a wait list.
Maybe it would be a 200, 300% growth. Yeah. But there was a lot of companies like that did that. Like, for example, Peloton, like the biking thing, they're like growing and then they put out this money, they build manufacturers and they're trying to go. And then COVID, and then they lost a bunch of people because now people can actually go out their house. Yeah. And the company now, it's a penny stock.
So how did you, what was the point in time where you said, hey, this is just not working? Clearly, you mentioned you have a customer call up or two and they say, hey, we're struggling getting this done or things aren't on time. What did it look like? Did someone on your team come to you and say, hey, I think we got to slow down? Or was it just something you saw from your position? We've got too many things happening in chaos all at once. Let's step back and figure out how to fix it.
Yes.
What did that look like?
Yeah, it was like basically me working like 12, 14 hours a day, balls being dropped, and I'm trying to help and trying to hire, trying to train. And like, then my health is going away again, like 40 pounds.
No time for soccer.
No time for soccer or cycling or anything.
Or cycling, yeah.
And so was just that realization that, wait, this is not worth it. This is diminishing returns. For what? I'm going to live in the same house. I'm going to drive the same car. I'm going to go on the same trips. I'm not going to go in trips because now I'm overworking. Yeah. So that was the moment when I was like, okay, we don't need to do this. And again, the optionality, because you don't have investors, we just were able to say no into growing a more consistent way.
That's curious. And how did you struggle? Did your team struggle when you said, hey, listen, we've just been growing a lot. We've got a lot of people. We've got customers waiting in the wings for us. They want us to build their stuff, but we're going to slow down. What did that look like, that conversation among your team?
Well, the team loved it. Like, the team felt like protected, right? The team understood the company prioritized their well-being over more profit or more money, right? Because the team is also overworked. Everyone is trying hard and you're dropping the ball. And no one likes to fail.
So yeah.
Customers are leaving. So the team was like, they felt appreciated and they work hard to figure out what we could do so we could scale, but we scale with quality and scale organized. So it was my idea, but the team really appreciated and they felt like it wasn't just about the money, it was about themselves too.
I love that. It goes back to the culture points that you were talking about before. So that's super important. What was the result of that? Did you guys continue to grow? Did you actually scale back? Because you said it was your biggest growth year ever. Did you keep that up for the next year in the sense of you were still growing just at a more measured pace, a more doable pace? What was the kind of the next step out of that after you decided, let's change, the team agrees, then yes. What happened?
Yeah, so then we still had customers that were willing to wait in the line, which was super impressive because at the time, also VCs were throwing a bunch of money in the market. And then we had a lot of VC fund customers that were telling the other companies in their portfolio what amazing job we were doing for them. And then they come, hey, you work with this company in the portfolio. We wanted to work with you. And I was like, yeah, would you be willing to put a deposit and come back in 3 months? And a lot of people say yes to that. And I was like, what?
Oh, so you actually started a new business model. So you weren't doing that before, were you?
No, I was just trying to onboard everyone that come to the door. Now people are coming to the door. And I'm like, yes, we'd love to have you. It's going to just take us 3 months to be able to start your project.
And just put a deposit down and we'll put you on the list.
Exactly. And then I kept trying, like I kept even raising the deposit and people kept paying. Yeah, hey. It's going to be $15,000, $25,000, $50,000.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting because you pushed one way. And a lot of people that I've talked to, either on the podcast or clients or elsewhere, that's what startup and scaling CEOs do, right? You're like, hey, let's try this. And if it works, you keep going. But if it doesn't work, you pull back and you try something else. And after you've tried a few things that don't work, you're like, wait, why are we not doing this? Why, in your case, why are we not maybe creating a waiting list. Why don't we ask for a bigger deposit or a deposit at all? And so it's interesting to see the evolution, how sometimes those closed paths open up new and better paths that are more aligned with your business.
Yes. And like people were willing to be in the wait list because of our reputation. And we were not taking customers to protect our reputation because, again, things start not going as planned. And yeah. So that showed that was the right thing to do because we had a reputation that people were willing to wait 3 months to work with us. But of course, there was a lot of business that we lost because some people needed help and they need it now. And they had all this cash to deploy. But that became like our new normal from them on. Our new normal, we plan on how much we're going to grow that quarter. And if for every reason it's more than what we plan to grow, we tell people next quarter.
Oh. So you've been able to maintain that then.
Exactly.
You just say, hey, this is how we keep our quality up. This is how we deliver on time. And that's like your competency is not just software development, but it's the program management. It's the projecting the timelines and how you deliver quality. I love that.
Yes. Like we really think like the thing we are building products. We're not just like developers for hire. We're not just adding heads to your team. We are coming here to think strategically and to build the product. And to do that, we sometimes need time to get people ready and to be able to onboard you. So that's what we do. And so that becomes the new normal. Like we basically now have limit spots of customers every quarter. And of course, if this quarter I got my spots filled too quick, I'm going to start thinking, what can I do so I have more spots next quarter?
Yeah.
So that's like how we do it.
That's fantastic. I'm glad it's going so well for you. We're probably over the time that I asked you to reserve for me. So I want to be respectful of your time. How will people get a hold of you? If they want, of course, to pay the deposit, get on your waiting list, be in your queue, where would they go? What should they do to find you?
Yeah, they can just go to devsquad.com and there's a form there. They're not going to meet me directly, actually. Again, think about the systems. If they just reach out there, they're going to end up talking with our account manager, which is going to help them understand how we work. And we'll make sure that we are a good fit for them and then see when's our next availability. If people want to speak with me directly, I'm also on LinkedIn. You can just search Phil Alves on LinkedIn and message me there. But if you're looking for DevSquad services, just go to devsquad.com and we have a whole flow, a whole funnel to get you through.
Awesome. Awesome. So this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for setting aside some time. I want to give you a chance, if you want, to end this on a high note with a piece of advice that you might give to another scaling CEO. What's somebody who's maybe not quite as far along as you, somebody who hasn't maybe experienced all the bumps or maybe the successes that you've experienced. What's that one piece of advice you wish you'd heard back when you were starting this journey 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think one thing that we spoke about offline that I like to apply and I tell people, the biggest risk is to think there's no risk. So you have to understand, if you think there's no risk, there's a lot of risks then. And so your job as a founder, as a CEO, is to understand the risks and to put the odds in your favor. And depending on who you are, how much experience you have, that will mean different things to you. So the kind of business that I can do today is different than the kind of business that I could do 10 years ago. And I believe people that are starting, they shouldn't try to do what I do today. They should do what I did 10 years ago. Yeah. And that's kind of like sometimes you look at some company like, that's what I want to be. But you don't have the resources. You don't have the experience that company or that person have. So you're not going to be able to replicate them that right now. And actually, I feel like the best person to give you a advice is somebody just a year ahead of you. If they are 10 years ahead of you, is a little bit too far.
So you're saying I shouldn't go out and buy a plane and try to fly it like I've got 400 hours right now. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Awesome. Awesome, Phil. Thank you so much for being on the show. It's been a real pleasure to chat. Like I said, when we first talked before the show, your background, I love it. The blue and the yellow. It's so lively. I think it's representative of how I feel the conversation has gone today, and you brought great energy. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So thank you for being on the show. And for the rest of our audience out there listening, thank you for joining us today. This is Jeff Holman with the Breakout CEO Podcast, and we'll catch you next time. I'll just stop this recording now.
How many of those have you done already?
Thanks for listening to the Breakout CEO Podcast. If today's conversation brought value or sparked ideas, I'd love for you to share this episode with a founder or leader in your network. If you're a scaling CEO with a powerful breakout story or an insight to share, make sure to apply to be a guest on our podcast at go.intellectualstrategies.com. Also, be sure to follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you enjoy the show, a rating or a review goes a long way. Our mission is to promote the stories of breakout CEOs in scaling SaaS, e-commerce, and tech companies to equip peer CEOs with valuable perspectives and confidence. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of The Breakout CEO. I'm Jeff Holman, and I'll see you next time.